On Monday, August 26th, Derek Rickey attended a city council meeting in Shawnee. The town was considering a non-discrimination ordinance to protect the rights of LGBTQ residents. Derek comes from a major Shawnee family. They've lived in Shawnee for generations, and the family name is known because of their construction company, Max Rickey & Brothers. They specialize in grading and excavation. This is big hometown business for Shawnee. Derek hadn't planned to speak at the meeting, but when he saw people he'd gone to church with wearing religious freedom t-shirts, he felt the need to address his community directly, to tell them about his journey from hiding that he was gay and fighting being gay to coming out and finding peace well into adulthood. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're going to hear that story now. Derek Rickey, thanks so much for being here.
Yep.
I've read your testimony from that meeting. It is really powerful. One of the lines that really got me was just you apologizing to the judge for shaking. Talk to me about that.
I was really nervous going into the meeting. I'm not a public speaker. I don't like being put on the spotlight. So I was really, really nervous, and I was going in front of people that I knew, I've known my entire life, family, friends, past church members that I attended church with, small groups, Bible studies, just people I'd come to know as family through my church community.
We're going to get into the details of your story shortly, but just generally speaking, you spent a lot of your life in denial about your sexual orientation. Were there people in that crowd, people you knew who were learning this part of your truth for the first time?
Yeah, I had several of them come up to me afterwards and basically told me that they were sorry for my experience and that they had no idea it was going on up until that moment when they heard it from me.
And as I've mentioned, your vice president, actually, of your family's company, Max Rickey & Brothers, I mentioned that this is your family business. I understand that this company has deep ties to Shawnee. Can you tell me a little more about that, about your family's role in this community?
Right. So my family moved to Shawnee 150 years ago. We were just on the north side of it. And living there, they got to see Shawnee grow up. They were very active. They helped form St. Joseph Catholic Church. And a lot, you know, there were two people that migrated here from Germany. Of those two, they had 10 kids. And then one of those 10 kids had 12 kids. So our family just grew and grew and grew and grew. I think currently we have about over 500 family members in and around Kansas City. So all the family members started doing things within the community and have always had different businesses and just well-known stuff going on. And the companies that a lot of the companies are construction companies. And so a lot of them are known by a lot of people.
Okay, I don't want to peddle in stereotypes here, and I realize that that's where this next statement kind of comes from, but I want to acknowledge when people imagine an outspoken LGBTQ advocate, their first guess of where that person works might not be a Kansas construction company.
Correct.
Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, so I typically don't speak up about these type of issues. I don't go around to people I work with or work for and say, hey, I'm gay. I mean, everyone that knows me personally knows that I am, but I don't go around to other job sites and basically broadcast that information. If they wanted to know, they could know or ask. So that's not my position. So when I did come out, I obviously had to tell the people I was working with. And when I told them, most of them are like, no, you're not. There's no way. And I'm like, yeah, I really, really am. And it turned out really, really good. I was completely blown away by the reaction. No one treated me differently. I think a lot of us became closer because we could just have more personal conversations and kind of joke about just different things differently.
So I want to get into the story that you told at this hearing. But going back a bit further, when did you realize that you were gay?
Good question. I think I probably realized it my entire life. I think I became most aware of the fact when I was around fourth grade. So in fourth grade, I knew for sure that I wasn't interested in girls and that I felt more attracted to boys.
Why do you think that your journey of acceptance extended so far beyond fourth grade.
Right. So times were a little bit different back then. I mean, it's not that long ago, but times were different. Being gay was not as accepted. I felt that if I had come out, I would be met with a lot of resistance from family members, church groups, different groups I was in, people at, you know, the company we worked for. And I was I didn't want to be gay. I was doing everything I could to not be gay. I was trying to, you know, I'd go to church and I'd try to pray the gay away, and I would talk to pastors, and, you know, I did not want to be gay.
When you say pray the gay away, can you explain that phrase?
Yeah, so I was kind of in self-denial. I didn't want to be at that in that position, and I would just spend a lot of time in prayer and asking God to take this thing that he'd given me, this position, this role that I was gay, take it away from me. I figured if he was the one that made me that way, he'd be the one to take it away. But years and years and years of praying the gay away didn't help.
Do you, when you, on this journey, I mean, your journey, wrestling was in large part a religious journey, even though you did go to church, but do I understand right? You didn't grow up super religious.
Right. So traditionally, my Ricky family was mainly all Catholic. There were some other members that went to other churches, but predominantly Catholic. And our family was very religious. And so my parents decided to bring us up in a household where we weren't forced to be one thing. We would go to church with friends. I would go to church with my grandma. And it just wasn't part of our every Sunday life.
So how did religion ultimately factor into your journey toward self-acceptance and then acceptance within a larger community?
Right. So after that period, my parents sent me, after going to public schools my entire life, my parents ended up sending me to St. Thomas Aquinas High School. And while I was there, I grew in faith, and I was attending all the church classes and learning more about the faith. And I felt a strong calling that I wanted to become Catholic. So in talking to a lot of those people, they decided they'd put a special ceremony together, and actually got baptized in the gymnasium of the school. We built a waterfall and a fountain that went from one corner of the gym to the other side. It was a really, really neat experience. And I can't remember if it was the archbishop or one of the top people in the diocese came in and actually did the
Wow, what a powerful experience.
Yep.
And something that you really chose for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely chose it for myself.
So as you went along in life, I mean, I understand that at some point you went through conversations about conversion therapy. Didn't make it through the initial screening stage, though. Please tell that story.
Yeah, so after... So before all this, I was married. I had two biological kids. After I got divorced, I think it was around 2011, I started dating another girl for 2 years. And at that point, we started to talk about getting married. And I kind of got a little scared. And I'm like, do I really want to go through this again? If I know that I'm gay, am I going to end up disappointing her, you know, in that situation? So I had talked to my priest, and he said there was a couple things that was offered through our diocese. And so I started attending a group called Courage, which was put on by Father Riley. And it was a very bizarre experience. You'd meet once a week in this classroom at the school, and you're just sitting there with a lot of other people that are in the same situation as you. But it felt like they were trying to change you. And none of the people I thought were being truly authentic to themselves about who they were. And I felt like most of them were lying about, you know, what they'd done that week, and that, oh, they no longer had that attraction. So I just felt very turned off by it. And as I told more and more people that I was gay at church, I decided to leave the Catholic Church. I just didn't feel accepted. So my girlfriend at that time, her parents attended a church called International House of Prayer, IHOP, and they're pretty involved with that. They talked to some of their pastors, and they got me set up for an interview for their Desert Stream program, which is a complete conversion type program. So I went up over there and met with the director of that, had a couple hour long interview with him, and by the end of the interview, he basically had told me that I would not be a good fit for their program because I had it set in my mind that I've tried to change myself for years and years and years. I can't change who I am. And he just got frustrated with the fact that I wasn't willing to try to put myself in that position. I think a lot of people that are gay have something called gaydar, where they can tell pretty good who around them might be gay. And the guy that I was talking to had said that he used to be gay and he's now converted and has a kid and family. But I just felt like he was being unauthentic and that he was hiding who he was.
So how did you move on from there? Because it seems like at this stage you were kind of in a gray area between self-acceptance and still looking for some sort of way out of what you maybe imagined were going to be hardships of like being fully embracing your identity as a gay man.
Right. So me being involved with different groups has always been important to me. My faith from high school on was always really important to me. So I started attending Church of the Resurrection in Leawood. They were very welcoming there. As a church policy, they hadn't yet accepted people who were gay, but they were still welcomed and loved and treated just like everybody else.
Can you explain how that works?
What part?
The official policy being not accepting that someone may be gay, but that in practice being very welcoming and loving and accepting.
Yeah, so the church, and I don't know all the specifics, but the church had a policy, the main Methodist church, the council or district or whatever you call it, has a policy that like money couldn't be spent towards any gay programming. They just weren't accepting of people being gay. They couldn't have any gay weddings. Clergy that came out as gay were basically forced to resign or go somewhere else. It was just a very non-accepting from the policy standpoint. But the people of that church, Adam had decided to be more welcoming, knowing that there was a need for people like me at the church, knowing that a certain percentage of the people that attended the church were probably hiding who they were. And he found that there was a need for that type of programming. So me and a couple of friends that I have that attended that church, we started a group, a weekly prayer group that met at my house every Monday night. And we were trying to come up with a fun name for it. So we ended up calling it Guys in Yahweh. And Adam had asked us why we chose that name, because he was really wanting to redo the gay programming, the LGBT programming. And he was making all the other groups change their names and change how they were run. And he's like, I just don't like your guy's name. He's like, you sound like it's a Jewish church group or something. And I started laughing, and I'm like, well, we had to come up with an acronym for something. And that's what we chose. The actual name of our group, Guys in Yahweh, stood for gay. So gay, Guys in Yahweh. So that's where that came from. He started laughing, and he thought that was awesome, and he let us keep our name.
So at this point, You're married to a man. You have a life that is built on acceptance of being gay. What was coming out like when you eventually did it? And were you really comfortable in your identity by then, or still nervous?
Yeah, so I've been out, if you will say, for probably 6 or 7 years. Coming out meant telling everyone that I was close to that I actually was gay. And I tried to do it as fast as possible because I didn't want someone else to hear it from somebody else and not find out firsthand. So I told my sister. She was one of the first ones I told. And she's like, Derek, I've known you're gay since you were like 2. And I'm like, oh, great. Well, thanks for telling me. You could have saved me a lot of time and effort. And then I told my dad. Surprisingly, he was very supportive. And he's like, you know what? Doesn't matter. I'll always love you. That was just awesome. I told my mom, and she kind of had a bad reaction. She got really upset and locked herself in the house for a period of about 2 to 3 weeks and wouldn't talk to anyone, wouldn't go out. So eventually a group of her friends went over to the house and basically broke into the house and drug her out to get her going again. And I think her main issue was she was scared that bad things were going to happen to me because I was gay. She was okay with me being gay.
She was afraid for you.
She was afraid. She ended up saying that she thought I'd get AIDS and die, or that I'd get myself in a really bad situation, or someone would want to hurt me.
When you think about what your mom was afraid of, we haven't talked about what you were afraid of.
I was just afraid in general. I didn't want to be gay. Why would anyone want to be gay? It's certainly, at that point, I thought it was a choice and it wasn't something you could choose between. I was just terrified. I didn't want to live that life. I didn't want the struggles that came along with people judging you and possibly hate crimes occurring. And it truly wasn't still accepted fully. You know, guys couldn't marry other guys yet. And it was just a rough situation to be in.
You mentioned in your testimony that your kids are in Shawnee schools and you don't want them to grow up with the same ideas about sexual orientation that were damaging to you.
Correct.
Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so like when I grew up going to elementary schools, and particularly at high school, the high school level, there was just always negative talk about being gay and it's not acceptable. And there's a lot of bullying that goes along with it. And then when I was at Aquinas, they really took it to a new level of saying that basically everyone gay was going to go to hell and there was no other way around it. And either that or live a life of solitude by yourself. And that was hard. And so I wanted my kids, you know, I don't know if either one of them are gay. I would rather they not be gay, because I still think it presents a possible struggle for them, possibly could exist, and I don't want them to have to go through that.
You feel that thing your mom felt, kind of.
Yeah, I do.
But regardless of whether they are or are not, you would like them to grow up in surrounded by different messages?
Yeah. We take them to different places. We've taken them to Pride. We take them to just different types of places where they get to see that people are different and that people can be different and it's okay.
I wonder if it's hard for you to ask the question out loud. A little while ago in this conversation, you said, why would anyone want to be gay? Does it feel painful for you to ask that question?
Yeah, because there's a lot of people out there that are just sold on the idea it's a choice. And why, if it's a choice, why would anyone choose to be gay? I think there's people that are bisexual and they can go both ways. But to be gay, it's not a choice. And so why would anyone choose to be gay?
It feels painful for me to hear you say it, and I'll tell you why. Because if I imagine myself saying something that I believe to be true about myself and then pairing that with, why would anyone want this? There's something very sad about that there's something about you that you wouldn't choose. Yeah, you're nodding at me.
Yeah, it's hard hearing all the time, oh, why did you choose to be gay? Well, heck, if I chose to be gay, I can tell you I would quickly go back and make that choice to go the other way. There's still struggles in life that being gay brings. And I'm glad with who I am now, but
you wouldn't choose the struggles.
I wouldn't choose the struggles. And now with all these cities going through these non-discrimination ordinances, I mean, there's still struggles. I mean, you could go theoretically to a store and they could say, hey, you're gay, you're not welcome here. Go to buy a house and try to rent it. And they would say, sorry, you're gay, you can't buy it. I mean, there's still true struggles that exist.
That brings me to this question of how has being part of this movement for a non-discrimination ordinance in Shawnee changed your relationship with the town of Shawnee, with the community there, and maybe even yourself?
I'm not typically a political person. I kind of got started thinking about it. There was a Pride picnic several months ago where they talked about the importance of the non-discrimination orders for the cities. And at that time, something kind of touched me. Something was placed on my heart that I needed to do something to help. And I probably was in a position to help. And so I started trying to figure out how to help and got involved. And hopefully future generations will have a positive impact by what we accomplished. That night, the most impressive speakers to me were when the kids came up and talked.
Tell me about that.
So just lots of high schoolers got up and talked, and most of them weren't gay. They were just there, and they'd say things like, man, we're in 2010, 2019, 2020 almost. Why is this still an issue? How can we still be talking about this? This should be a non-issue. And they would go on and on and on about how their friends deserve the same rights that the rest of us have. And it was just really impressive.
I wonder, when you mention seeing people in t-shirts about religious freedom, I imagine that with your backstory, you probably understand the thinking behind those slogans in a way that most other people making the case you are making might not understand. Is there some break in communication that you think that you have some clarity around that people really who have been on some level like in a bubble on one side or the other might not understand?
I don't know. Looking back, if that issue had come up, I would probably I would go along with them and do the same thing. I'd probably be wearing the sticker and be fighting for freedom of religion and be against the gay thing. But I think many times I find the people that are pushing most hard against it are really gay themselves, and they're just not in a position to come out yet.
Yeah, this is definitely a theory that a lot of people share. When you think about the time when you were afraid to come out, afraid it might make your life harder, have any of the specific fears you harbored from that time come true?
I relate it to being bullied. So the fears of, there was the fear of losing friends and family and thinking that I would have nowhere to live. I'd have none of my same friends. I wouldn't be able to support myself. None of those things really occurred. But I did get bullied quite a bit by random people, like just out and about. So that has happened. I've never gone to a restaurant and they said, sorry, you can't eat here because you're gay. So I'm thankful for that. So yes and no.
Derek Rickey, Vice President of Max Rickey and Brothers in Shawnee, father, husband, and now out as a gay man. Thank you so much for telling your story.
You're welcome.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And in just a minute, we'll be turning our focus to playgrounds, who they're built for, and the effort to make them accessible to more kids out there. That's next. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking now about playgrounds, specifically accessibility on playgrounds. The Metro is seeing a burst of new playgrounds built with inclusivity in mind. The most recent one opened in Shawnee Mission Park this summer, and it was packed on Labor Day. Kids of all ages and differing abilities were having a blast together. There is an organization called Variety KC behind the fundraising to make these playgrounds possible. My next guest joins us from that organization, Deb Wiebrecht. Good good morning.
Good morning, Gina. Thanks for having us. We're so excited to be here.
Tell me the story of how these playgrounds came to be, how Variety KC came to be.
Sure.
I assumed when I first started seeing these playgrounds that it was a new organization, but that's really not the case.
Well, first, I'm glad you visited the playgrounds. And what did you think of them?
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
This is about more than me.
It's more than you. And actually, it is more than you, right? It's about a quarter of the population in Kansas City of kids that have special needs. A quarter of our population, think about that, have disabilities. And Variety Children's Charity has been around Kansas City for 85 years, serving that population. And what's happened is it's kind of evolved. We started as a charity to provide mobility equipment for kids with disabilities. And I like to say any child or a variety of child, we help a variety of children with a variety of special needs, whatever their needs are, whether it's a wheelchair, an adaptive bike, a communication device, a van ramp.
So explain how a playground becomes accessible to the people with all the needs you just described.
Well, absolutely. So once we provide that equipment to the children,
what kind of equipment can they do
with it? Wheelchairs and mobility devices. Where can they go? What can they do? So parents came to Variety and said, boy, we need a place in the community that we belong, and we want our kids just to be kids. So we actually started by building two adaptive baseball fields that allowed kids to have what I call parallel play. When you play with an able-bodied kid, when you have a child with special needs, they play side by side. They learn tolerance, acceptance, diversity, and they get to play just like every other child. When we saw the success of those, we thought, wow, let's build a playground right next to our baseball field in Olathe. When we did that, the light turned on. Because these kids are coming out of the woodworks to say, we've got a place to play with other kids. And when you play with other kids on a playground, it's at the raw state, right? You just get to be a kid. You get to enjoy sunshine. You get exercise. And you get to form friendships. Whereas a lot of times a special needs community is invisible because they don't have an opportunity to go and play, or parents kind of direct kids away from children that may look different or act different. These playgrounds are a stepping stone for friendships to be built, for long-term success, so that we can start our inclusion revolution, as like we'd like to call it in Kansas City.
What goes into creating an inclusive playground that those of us who just show up and play might not consider?
You know, if you have a mobility device that you use, whether it's braces or a walker or wheelchairs, you know, those can't go on mulch. Those can't go on stones. Those can't go down hills very easily. And a lot of times, playgrounds are designed by landscape artists because they want it to look beautiful. Well, that is a deterrent for a lot of our kiddos, because our kiddos need to be able to use the entire scope of the playground. So we call it soft foam for surfacing on the bottom. So if they fall, they won't get hurt, but it's flat. We call them ramps to go up to the device so the child can get on the top of the playground like other kids and play alongside. Also, we need tents for kids with light sensitivity issues, because when you have special needs, sometimes you overheat a little bit more. So tents. We also like to have all of our Variety KC playgrounds have fences, because kids with boundary issues are usually runners or roamers, and families want to go enjoy a playground, moms and dads too, and socialize. And they don't want to have to worry about their children running away or going into a parking lot or into a street. So it's a safety concern too.
Does this reflect a new kind of thinking? Because these aren't playgrounds for kids with disabilities and no one else. They're truly inclusive, as in for everyone. And as I mentioned, I've gone to them with my son. I love them for him, and he doesn't have a disability. I just think the creative thinking about what constitutes play is really refreshing. And I will say, I don't generally know which kids are there for accessibility specifically and which kids are there because it's their neighborhood park or whatever. And that's kind of cool.
And Gina, that's the new normal we want to see. Once these kids get out in the community and start forming these friendships, you know, I work with 100,000 children with special needs. And when I go do something, I sometimes myself have to stop and say, oh yeah, can Maddox come with me because he's in a wheelchair? Because when you get to know their true hearts and them as people and their insides and their interests, they're so tolerant and they're so resilient and they're so wonderful. They become true friends and you forget that they have special needs. And isn't that what we want for our children? To look at everybody, everybody with acceptance and inclusion.
Nancy Truitt is with us now. She's a mom of a 16-year-old. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
So tell me about your son.
I have a 16-year-old son named Maddox, and Maddox's primary diagnosis are cerebral palsy and Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So right now he's in a wheelchair. He uses when we're out and about in the community, we tend to use a manual wheelchair. At school, he uses a power wheelchair. So if we were in the park, we would probably be in the manual wheelchair because it's a little easier for me to maneuver. We had a park in Leawood open near our house, and that was really exciting for us. Maddox loves to go to the park, but if you're at a normal park, he can't sit on a swing because the swing doesn't have a back, or he can't go down the slide because I would have to be able to lift him to carry him down the slide and then provide support for him. So the fact that there are now playgrounds out there where the swings have backs and there's ramps to the top is really exciting for us.
Tell me about the slides, too. Describe the slides.
So, well, I guess we haven't – there's so much other fun stuff. We haven't spent a lot of time on the slides. Maddox's
zip line.
Maddox's favorite is the zip line because it's taken the idea of a swing to a whole new level.
Yeah, describe the zip line.
And a zip line
we'll get to the slide.
And is something, you know, that he would never have been able to do before because he can't hold on and support himself. And so the zip line is literally a big – you know, it's a seat with a back and a strap across his chest. And you start at an incline and go down, you know, the rope.
A zip line. True zip line.
Yeah. And it's just exciting. You know, you're moving. He's an action junkie. So he's moving fast and the wind is blowing in his face. The other thing that he really likes is the disc swing.
Because I've seen that. It's
the big round disc mm-hmm. that he can lay on either on his stomach or his back. And again, you know, he's swinging back and forth with the wind blowing in his face. And those two things have really, thankfully for me, we've moved away from the slide because I still, even though if there's a ramp up to a slide, I still have to go on with him to provide support. So for me, we've moved away from that, but we've moved towards more exciting things like the disc swing and the zip line. And there are a lot of things that he can use, boards. There are communication boards for kids that are visually impaired. And so typically under the structure where it's shaded,
you climb up to go down a slide, but then underneath that area, there's a whole play area.
And a whole play area. And it's a really good opportunity to, one, to be in the shade because he's a child that tends to overheat because he can't regulate his body temperature. And, you know, play parallel to other kids. He has a very big imagination, so he loves to play imaginary games, and that provides a great opportunity for him to do that.
What historically have been some challenges that you and your family have encountered on traditional or what you might call conventional playgrounds?
Well, and Nancy is good because the Leawood playground really wasn't traditional. So can you explain how you helped that become
inclusive? I want you to stick with, actually, the question about the challenges you encountered.
Traditionally, slides, swings, tunnels. Traditionally, everything is a challenge for me, starting with the surface of the playground. You know, the surface is typically mulch or rocks, which is really hard to push a wheelchair through. And if you catch the wheelchair on anything, there's a chance that I'm going to eject the Maddox from his wheelchair if the seatbelt is not secure enough. But, you know, he can't crawl through those tunnels. The slides, I have to take him out of his wheelchair and carry him up and hope that the slide is wide enough for me to get down. And, you know, if it's a tunnel slide, you know, I'm not going to bang my head. And the swings, the swings are just a no-go.
As you have also been on this journey, you've been on this journey with more than one child.
I have two children. My oldest is a freshman in college this year, and he's, I guess, what you would call a typical child. And so it's been such a different experience, you know, from raising an able-bodied child who did everything easily and very early, and then Maddox, who everything has just, you know, been a struggle, and you have to think and plan, you know, 10 steps ahead.
What I'm curious about is how you have historically planned for something like a play outing with these two different children who you're just one person.
Well, thankfully, my oldest child is very independent and very compassionate. And so he is actually his brother's biggest advocate and support system. You know, with my oldest child, we always just jumped into the car. If we were feeding the ducks at a playground, we you know, grabbed a loaf of bread and we hit the road. And with Maddox, you have to stop and think, you know, are you taking the walker? Are you taking the wheelchair? What's the surface of the ground like? You know, will he need a hat so he doesn't overheat? Just, you know, typical, where are you going to park your car? Because if you're in a handicap vehicle, you know, my handicap van doesn't fit in every parking spot. So you just, there's a lot more things to consider.
Hold that thought. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And you can join this conversation about accessibility, different ability, and different kinds of play at kcur.org/centralstandard or at 816-235-2888. Share your experiences, ask your questions. There's just a little time left, though, so call now. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking accessibility and play with local mom Nancy Truitt and Deb Wiebrecht of Variety KC that is behind a lot of the accessible playgrounds you're starting to see throughout the metro. Hi again, you two.
Hi.
So, Nancy, the idea of kids of all ability ranges playing together is so great for a lot of the reasons you just described, even just that you could a parent with two kids, one with a disability, one without disabilities, can go to the same playground and all have fun. That's huge. Are there new scenarios to navigate as these kids all encounter one another?
You know, I guess the only thing left to navigate is, you know, developing relationships outside of the playground. Parallel play is such a neat idea because an able-bodied child at the playground sees that my child isn't just in a wheelchair. He's just a child just like they are. And you know, he's approachable. It's, you know, he's not scary or something different because he sits in a wheelchair. He's just Maddox and he just wants to play too.
And you feel like those interactions have gone smoothly?
Yes. Kids with kids, yes, kids aren't afraid to ask questions, and I'm happy to answer anything they ask. They're just curious. They're typically innocent questions. Really, it's exciting for me because parents get to see more than kids. Parents get to see that my child is just a child, and you know he goes beyond the person they see in the wheelchair. It's parents who typically have shied away from my child or discouraged their child from asking questions. So, To me, the benefit is twofold. You know, he gets to parallel play and the able-bodied child gets to see he's just like them. But the parent gets to see that Maddox is just a kid, too.
Speaking of parents, I was thinking about parents with disabilities. I imagine that these playgrounds are super useful for them, too.
Yes, they could, I mean, easily participate alongside their child because it's a soft, smooth surface. You know, a parent with a disability who has an able-bodied child doesn't, you know, they could go to the top of the playground structure. You know, they could wheel around and play on the boards under the structure. So, yeah, I mean, it's outstanding.
Deb, I understand that there are details to consider given the range of different abilities people might bring to the playground that even the designers don't always think of. Is there such a thing as a 100% inclusive playground, or are you always learning about things that might pose an obstacle for someone somewhere?
Personally, Variety is always learning, but we're learning from our parents, who, again, are the, you know, the experts in the field. So when designers come, we've had a couple cities approach us with what they thought were inclusive plans that we just won't partner with because it truly isn't accessible as we would like it to be. Anything with a hill or rocks, we would keep away from that project. And Nancy describes it really well with Maddox, that if Maddox is playing alongside with a child on a playground, you don't want to have to play up to a sidewalk and have to stop while your friends are still running. You want to run with them and play with them and dream with them throughout the entire playground.
So another question that I have has to do with some of the specific things, just my own curiosity about the thought behind them. There are a lot of music stations at these playgrounds where you'll see like a row of different kinds of almost like bongo drums that are anchored into the ground, and then xylophones, things like that. Kids, when you talk about playing alongside, it's almost like they're having this sort of unintentional jam session or something. Can you talk to me about the the thinking behind those stations?
Well, they're all at a level that would be a level for wheelchairs or strollers, so everyone can play and everyone can create music together. And to me personally, in Kansas City, I think the arts is an area that really needs to think about inclusion, that we haven't gotten to the place that we need to, because some kids don't always just love sports. Some kids want to enjoy and explore music and the arts. And I think it's important for us as a city to open up everything that we do to every child.
Let's talk to Tom. Tom is calling us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Tom.
Hey, I'm trying to get you off speaker. I worked with the disabled children for decades, formulating IEPs for schools, as well as disabled adults, often with severe CP. And now I'm disabled myself due to some accidents. And this city is the worst possible city in the world for disability access. People take our parking spots, don't even fully able-bodied in their huge SUVs. In the stores, they put the handicap parking 100 feet away from the front door while able-bodied parking's put up at the front. Our Jackson County, if you want to go in there and file against those outrageous taxes, you can't even get in there if you're handicapped because of all these stairs, and there's no parking in the back because it all goes to police officers. Our sidewalks don't exist in many areas, and when they do exist, they don't have the ramp effect down so she could take her son's wheelchair up on them. The phone provider in town, I was in the store the other day, has no accessibility for the handicapped. This is the least accessible, least friendly handicapped town I've ever found. Yesterday, I had to ask a young woman who was riding my cart around in the store to please get off because I'm severely impaired right now.
In the grocery store?
Yeah, and she looked incredulous, and she just got up and walked away. And I was like, this is not a toy or a fun ride. There's disabled people, and as our population ages out, it's just going to get worse. So thank you for hearing me.
Wait.
I needed to get
out. Wait.
Go ahead.
Before you go.
Go ahead.
I am curious,
okay,
when you hear about, we heard the comment earlier that the next step to navigate is forming relationships off the playground, and you're talking about some of the challenges to doing that. Can you talk to me about how all of the things you just described affect your ability to form relationships in these spaces?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you can't access, for example, I had a fall a week ago where I was already disabled, but now I'm even further disabled. And I am so isolated in my home that the ability to get out and interact with other people is completely dependent on disability accessibility in terms of getting up ramps, getting into stores, and just meeting other people. And we become severely isolated, and you have much higher rates of depression. Suicidality is not uncommon, and you have burnt out parents and care providers. And frankly, I have found the only time you actually get any action is when someone just like the lady speaking now forms a group and takes dramatic actions and just keeps at it, because you can't get bureaucrats to move on this stuff, and private business doesn't want to make any expense on it. So yes, it severely impairs our ability to be in the social sphere.
Well, Tom, thanks for that call, and I'm sorry about your struggles. I hope you find what you're needing. Nancy, respond to what you just heard.
I want to say I agree with him. Without my son has a very isolating diagnosis, and without an organization like Variety, I initially got connected with them because they helped get him a bicycle several years ago so he could go outside and ride a bike just like any of his friends could. And without an organization like Variety that takes the lead and the initiative to help kids get bikes or communication devices or put accessible shopping carts in grocery stores, you know, we've started a sled hockey program. Now we're doing playgrounds.
Wait, what's sled hockey?
Sled hockey. Yeah, so kids with handicapped kids and kids with special needs can go to the rink and play hockey and have an opportunity to experience a sport. And now these playgrounds, without any of these things, my son would be sitting at home in his room on his iPad by himself, and he would never know other kids and they would never know him.
That's a very hard thing to think about. And I'm guessing that with a 16-year-old, that this is change that you have witnessed over his lifetime.
And as it's, you know, and I hate to say that it's easier when he's little, it's a lot easier to do play groups and expose him to other children. But the older he gets, you know, now he's a sophomore in high school, you know, his peers start to move down a different path. You know, everybody's gaming and he doesn't game, or they're all taking off in cars or going on dates. And that's something that's very hard for him to do. So he's left behind. So these opportunities allow him a chance to get out in the community and socialize with other people.
What kinds of spaces would you like to see become more accessible as you think about having a teenager specifically?
Bathrooms. Bathrooms are a nightmare for us. I think all bathrooms need to move to putting adult changing tables in them. You know, right now when we have to use a bathroom, my son wears an adult, a brief, rather than underwear. And so we don't fit on a changing table. They're made for infants and toddlers. And there are times when I have to consider which section of the floor is the least dirty to lay him down on because there's nowhere for me to change him.
This absolutely breaks my heart. I mean, it's so obvious as you explain it, but it's something that so many of us don't even think about, which brings me to a question about the education piece of it. I mean, it seems like a playground where kids are interacting and where parents are interacting is the perfect kind of place for people to start thinking about and encountering what other people in their community might be dealing with or up against.
Correct.
Have you had interactions where you think that person's going to leave here getting it?
I think so. You know, by being on the playground, you're just opening up and offering somebody the opportunity to say, you know, hey, you know, Maddox, why are you in a wheelchair? And we can explain that his leg muscles don't, you know, work as well. And so he uses a wheelchair. And, you know, maybe that little boy says, hey, maybe I can push him. And, you know, that little boy's mom watches, you know, her son pushing mine up the ramp to get to the top, and maybe something will click with her and she'll say, oh, you know, that ramp really makes sense to me now. That little boy could never have gone up steps if there had been steps. And so it just starts a thought process.
Deb, I'm guessing that you hear stories like this.
Well, I hear stories like this, yes, and that's what creates the change. And I love what your caller said, because everything he said is true. But the more we educate the community and the more we're out there in droves and people see this community, change will happen. It's slow, but it's happening. We're actually partnering with the new airport to develop two inclusive play areas in the new international airport and a sensory room. It'll be the first in the world, and that's right here in Kansas City.
When you say sensory room, what is that?
A sensory room is when someone has anxiety or autism or gets anxious a little bit. It's going to be a quiet room that will allow them to calm down with low lighting, and just to ease their nerves a little bit so they can re-enter their world.
With the range of different abilities, different diagnoses, and all that those entails, that those entail in different spaces, and how those spaces would pose all kinds of challenges, from levels of sensory input to how much you might be overheating, to whether your whether equipment like wheelchairs can move over surfaces. It seems like a huge challenge to create a space that accounts for all of those things.
You know, I always say that if you know better, you do better. And when you get to know these kids and know these families and know their needs, you do better. And then it's easy. It's not that they need special treatment. They just need special equipment. And that's what Variety provides.
Nancy, when you think about challenges going forward, what would you've mentioned bathrooms. What else? What would you like to see people addressing?
You know, my fear going forward as Maddox gets older is, you know, what I do with him after high school. He graduates from high school in 3 years, and what happens to him then? So I would like to see it move into a lot more social opportunities for adults.
Programming,
like, you know, with the caller we just spoke to.
Opportunities people to gather.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our time is up, but Deb Wiebrecht, Nancy Truitt, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thank you for sharing.
You can grab either of this morning's conversations online at kcur.org/centralstandard. They'll be ready for you by the end of the day. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we will be talking to Anthony of the Queer Eye Show on Netflix. He's coming to town with a surprisingly autobiographical cookbook, and I can't wait to talk to him about it. Tune in for that conversation and more tomorrow at 10, and talk to us on Twitter anytime. We're at KCURCST. This show is produced by by Melody Rao with Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and intern Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is coming right around the corner, so stay tuned for Steve Kraske. Next.